The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Sleeveen politics and baying mobs. Rick Batts fly as Simon Harris survives the no-confidence vote. Has the Conservative Party become blue chip? We hear the latest from Westminster. And are some property tax bills an unfair double whammy? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate, but first the news with Paul O'Flynn. Good evening and welcome to the Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining us tonight we have Fianna Fáil spokesperson on education and skills and TD for Meath East, Thomas Byrne, Fine Gael senator and Shannon spokesperson on health, Colm Burke, Labour councillor for Dunleary and former Minister of State at the Department of Health, Alex White, political editor with the Irish Examiner, Daniel McConnell, and political correspondent for the journal.ie, Christina Finn. Now, we want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551. You can email us on latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebaterte. Now, first to Sinn Féin's motion of no confidence in the Minister for Health, Simon Harris. Party leader Mary Lou MacDonald took aim at Fianna Fáil today, saying their confidence and supply deal with Fine Gael was no more than Sleeveen politics, while the party spokesperson on health, Louise O'Reilly, attacked the Minister's record in his department.
How can anyone defend an expected cost overrun on the National Children's Hospital of €450 million? I could go on, but I only have 5 minutes, not 5 hours. The simple fact is that nobody can defend it. No one except you and the opportunistic cowards in Fianna Fáil. It is incompetence and a lack of ability which have brought us here today. Past performance is, I believe, an indicator of future performance. But your past performance makes me certain that you are not up to the job of being Minister for Health. You are out of your depth, Minister.
The Taoiseach, Leo Varadkar, reaffirmed his confidence in the beleaguered Minister for Health while attacking Sinn Féin's political tactics.
We hear a lot about accountability in this House. But accountability at its most simple is about taking responsibility for your actions and answering for them. Accountability is not giving in to the baying mob, the thirst for bloodletting, and a head on a plate every other day. A baying mob doesn't provide answers and it doesn't provide solutions.
Leo Varadkar there speaking in the Dáil during that no confidence debate today. Thomas Byrne, you're a crowd of opportunistic cowards, says Louise O'Reilly.
Well, look, I don't take that seriously at all. I think, you know, therein lies the entire purpose of the Sinn Féin motion, which, if you listen to their speeches, were more directed at Fianna Fáil than at Simon Harris. So I think, you know, we don't take that seriously. It doesn't bother us in the slightest. We've a commitment there to stick by the confidence supply agreement. We've extended that because of Brexit. We're determined to do that. But we're also determined to seek answers, to ask questions, to hold this government to account in relation to the Children's Hospital, the cervical cancer scandal, and we're not finished actually on that. One thing is certain to kill an issue from a government point of view, and that is a successful or an unsuccessful motion of confidence. It rallies the government together, they all protect each other, and oftentimes when a minister resigns, the issue just goes away. That we've seen recent examples of that.
What would have happened if you had backed that motion, if you had voted with Sinn Féin and that no confidence motion today?
If we wanted to remove the minister from office, we have the power to do that. So we would have had our own motion of confidence down. We saw when Francis Fitzgerald had to resign, that was a result of lengthy discussions over weekends and weeks between the Taoiseach and Micheál Martin. So this has happened before, may happen again, but we wouldn't be doing what other parties are trying to force.
Now, hang on a second now, we've been told all week you couldn't do it. It would be an act of national sabotage because it would bring down the government. But you're acknowledging now that it would not have brought down the government.
No, I'm not acknowledging that because almost certainly the Taoiseach would have run to the park, blamed Fianna Fáil for catastrophe. What we're watching in England...
Do you really believe the Taoiseach would have run to the park 38 days out from Brexit?
They've been angling for an election for quite some time, but when we're looking at the instability in England, the collapse really of the traditional political order, collapse of factories, of business, of the basic economy is going down very, very quickly actually. We don't want the same to happen here. We don't want to be the cause of that. And we think that it is very important for the time being to ensure that there is stability in government. We'd rather be in that government ourselves. And but for Brexit, there is no doubt we'd be here on an election debate. There'll be an election probably next week.
Alex White.
Yeah, well, I mean, Alan Kelly made the point in his speech that it was a bit of a distraction, the motion. I mean, the Labour Party doesn't have confidence in the government, so it voted against them. But the actual motion itself was a bit of a distraction. And, you know, I have a sense that it's just a symptom of a real kind of dysfunctionality in the Dáil at the moment. Actually, a very disturbing one. I think Brendan Helen was saying it's almost like as if we've taken it from, you know, the dysfunctionality in the House of Commons has kind of been repeated in the Dáil. And it is true, I have to say, I've some sympathy what the Taoiseach said, small amount of sympathy for this notion that accountability can be reduced to scalps.
But and that's the way it, politics has become. Has it not always
well, it's
been thus,
because it is.
Alex
it's the only
Weiss.
Instrument available
in fact,
to an
famously, office. It was your own leader back in the day that I came know. Looking for a head.
That's right.
And in those terms.
On more than one occasion.
Fine Gael did it in opposition as well. Mary Harney was constantly facing.
So this isn't new. Let's not pretend that this is a new development.
I'm not saying it's a new development. Not for 1 minute am I saying that. But what I am saying is it is distraction, particularly at the moment, in the context that we're in. But obviously the Labour Party presented with an emotion. We're certainly not going to support this government, the particularly, you know, when you see what's happened in relation to the Children's Hospital and the management of that issue. So, I mean, there are bigger questions, though, and I think you're right to ask, I mean, Thomas, about this question of what would have happened had the vote, in fact, gone through. And I think there almost certainly would have been a general election because I think Leo Varadkar made, you know, he's lost Francis Fitzgerald, he's had other defeats. It would be impossible for this government to limp on, it seems to me, even with Brexit, if they had lost another minister. And I think they would have almost certainly had an election. So, you know, I can, from Fianna Fáil's point of view, they make their own decisions. It places them in an extremely difficult situation.
So you had a free
situation.
Pass then, like the Labour Party.
Well, we voted against the government.
Yeah, exactly as I'm them. Saying. You didn't, yeah. You voted against the government,
well,
yet you believe it was
fair.
Wrong to have
no,
the motion
fair.
In the first
no,
place.
I mean, I'll take that criticism. I'm not in the Dáil, I'd be honest about it. It places Fianna Fáil in an extremely difficult position because they are both in and out at the same time. And it's extremely difficult for them. And, you know, I feel their pain.
I think what people at home, probably from watching this drama of the National Children's Hospital over the last number of weeks, are calling for is accountability. Perhaps emotion, whether you agree or not, was seeking that. But there are bigger questions that have still gone unanswered. I know Thomas Byrne says that, you know, Fianna Fáil are going to push to get those answers. And, you know, cervical check has been raised, in fairness, a lot by Micheál Martin. And so has Children's Hospital costs. But we're still seem to be no closer in terms of the drip feed of information from the government. About that, and but I think
that wasn't what tonight was about.
Yeah, but
though,
I think
it?
Tonight no. There was a lack of humility, I think, shown from the government
yes,
today.
Yeah.
I felt watching it; it was very much party politics at play, be it Sinn Féin or Fianna Fáil, but also having the Taoiseach say that the health ministry is one of the toughest jobs and is perhaps a Taoiseach in training sort of territory.
Yeah,
is not what,
you know,
what
is
people
that an
want.
Extraordinary, Colin, but I want to ask you about that because that jumped out at us watching that today. That it's some sort of like an internship for being Taoiseach, that's one of the most important ministries that has such an impact on people's lives.
Absolutely.
Is somewhere you go to learn to be Taoiseach.
Well, one of the things about health is that if you look at alone at the HSE, there's 135,000 people employed in the HSE at the present time. Now, that's a huge number of people, which is answerable to a Department of Health and then answerable to a minister. So it's a huge portfolio that you're dealing with, and it is very challenging. I would imagine that in any one day there are at least 20 crises that a minister has to make a decision on, and it's not a decision, well, I'll take a decision on that tomorrow. It's a decision that you have to take here and now, because there are people's lives. And I can remember one case that came to my attention on a Friday, and the minister was out of the country. And in fairness, his department took it on, but they had to wait until the minister came back for a decision to be taken. And he reversed a decision taken by the HSC at 7 o'clock on a Friday night because it was the wrong decision taken. But the minister wouldn't even have been aware of that decision only for the fact that I became aware of it.
Okay, can
so
I just...
So they're the kind of things that are happening. So it's, you know, day by day, hour by hour, decisions are put in front of him where he has to make his mind up on.
Surely, Cullenberg, that's every minister, every senior minister at cabinet must be prepared and must have an onslaught of decision making.
But you see, if you look at health and the number of people, you know, the health department is looking after the health of the entire country in real terms, because there are decisions taken which affect each and every one of us, and therefore a decision that is taken today will have, could have a long-term detrimental effect. And that's why it's so important that you have a minister there that's able to make decisions. Sometimes you do get it wrong, and there's no question or doubt about that, but I would hope that in the vast majority of occasions that the minister has had to take a decision, he's got it right, and he's got it right.
Can I ask you, Danny, just in relation to what Christina said there about the lack of humility in the tone of the government's response to this, not just today, I think, but in recent times. And I was struck by the tweet that Simon Harris put up first thing this morning. And for people out there who don't have access to a tweet machine, I'll try and do it justice. So it was basically the sort of motivational poster that you can get online, which stated, "The struggle you're in today is developing the strength you need for tomorrow." And along with that, the minister wrote, "Bring it on!" Exclamation mark. "We've worked together on Repeal the Eighth, passed the Public Health Alcohol Bill, helped out CF patients access new medicine, introduced the HPV vaccine for boys, and developed a cross-party 10-year plan to reform our health service. So much more to do."
All of which is true. All of which is true.
So yeah, but tone is very important.
What I'm asking about is the tone of that whole bring it on.
Like, I mean, I saw it, and even some of Simon Harris's strongest supporters were cringing when they saw it themselves this morning. Like, he's clearly a man under pressure. He's clearly a man who was, you know, like, the game is getting away from him without question.
Is that the minister himself, though? Is there somebody running
a communication strategy, he's very media savvy, and he's open to very much to the media in terms of like that. And he's very much in tune with public relations and spin and all the rest of it. So, you know, and I would think it's him. Maybe in conversation that they probably had a discussion, but it probably, you know, decided a good idea to put it out this morning. It landed badly.
And Daniel, can I just finish my point, if you don't mind,
Like, it set the tone for a day, and I thought the Taoiseach at various stages in the day struck a very arrogant tone. When not only in relation to the motion of no confidence, I don't know if you saw the interaction he had with Breed Smith earlier on. I mean, this sort of very high-handed, classic Fine Gael arrogance sort of that just has dripped. Like, it was a hallmark of Enda Kenny's tenure as Taoiseach. Like, this very high-handed, we know best, you're a little Labour Party, you're a little Fianna Fáil, go away from us, leave us alone. But what struck me as well is just how impotent Fianna Fáil were left by the whole debate today, by because they're bound by the confidence supply. I mean, one of their own members said we are reduced to political eunuchs, was how they described themselves. And I think, you know, that's the difficulty. And I think the clear idea of Sinn Féin putting down the motion was to put the squeeze on Fianna Fáil, and that was
There was one Sinn Féin TD's entire speech was about Micheál Martin, not about Simon Harris.
Yeah.
And there was lots of examples of that. There was also Jim Daly, the Fine Gael minister, who I have to say, and you know, we attack Fine Gael, they attack us, but I have to say, on this particular motion to launch into a tirade against Fianna Fáil, I thought was the height of cheekiness, and again the Fine Gael arrogance on full display.
Thankless, you might say.
We don't care, because we know what we're doing is in the national interest. We know that, and we have a strategy for the country and for the party. But you know,
which order, is that the party first or the country first? I said the country first, actually, and then I said the party.
It's just that's
what we're doing. But you know, we're not political eunuchs, actually, because a lot of the information that's been dragged out on this issue has been dragged out by Fianna Fáil TDs.
Yeah, but Katie, I think it's important as well, though. The minister has been under tremendous pressure for the last 5-6 weeks. He's entitled to defend himself, because a lot of the spin that had been put out by the other parties has not been true.
Yeah,
and I mean,
in
fairness to him, he's taken a decision on a number of issues that a lot of people kicked the can down the road. Like, you take the repeal of the Eighth Amendment, you take in relation to the Children's Hospital, we've got on with it. How many ministers for health have we gone through since the Children's Hospital was first mooted? Back in 1962, I worked out tonight that there's been at least 30 ministers for health that it has gone through. And we've taken a decision to move on with it, get it built and get it delivered.
But I think actually someone who whatever you disagree with some of his points made in the Dáil, he knows what he's talking about, is Mick Wallace, in terms of construction and tendering process. And he has appealed to the government to stop and halt this construction. And I think he made some pretty valid points in terms of, you know, he constantly actually does speak face to face nearly to Leo and to Simon and appeals to them, please hire advisors that know what they're doing in terms of procurement and in terms of building and all the rest. And yet again, we do see that, is it a case of we are just building this at whatever cost?
I just want to put to Alex something that your Labour Party colleague Alan Kelly said in his speech in the Dáil today. He told it all. Bad politics has destroyed the Ministry of Health. Bad politics of 30 years has turned the department into the ministry the Taoiseach of the day gives to his pupil who needs to be brought down a peg or two. And obviously he was saying the same applied to the Taoiseach with his predecessor. Now, the current Labour leader was a Minister for Health during this period. Mm-hmm. You were a Minister of State in that department during this period. Did you go in with a hard hat under your arm every day, or is there something uniquely dysfunctional about the Department of Health?
I don't think there's anything unique. There's something uniquely dysfunctional about the Department of Health. Alan Kelly also said that he finds it very, very irritating and dispiriting to have the Department of Health constantly referred to as Angola, which was, I think, a famous phrase that was
Brian Pound coined. Yes,
and it isn't Angola, and he's absolutely right. And people, the Department of Health and the health services generally are absolutely critical. We don't have to explain why. It's obvious why it's so important. And it's a pity that it's treated in this manner by so many people, including commentators, that, you know, it's a hellhole, it's a terrible place to go politically.
But Alex,
so
why does that
you
not
do
because
so many
people
there.
Feel let down by
well,
the
yeah,
Department
people
of Health.
Do. People feel let down, but the health service is actually incredibly successful.
Absolutely.
As well. Like, yeah. This country has a higher population than it ever had before, a higher number of procedures and options and possibilities for people to live longer lives, better quality of lives. When people talk about outcomes or where the outcomes are people actually living more fulfilled lives and longer
people
lives.
Do you think Simon Harris is doing a very good job?
I think he's doing... Well, I think that he's doing a good job. I think that other ministers for health of all parties have done good jobs in there. But it's an extremely difficult portfolio. And it's not helped by the fact that people turn around and describe it all the time as I'm going, it's a terrible place to be. And it is, but it is politicised. It has been politicised by all parties over many years. And it needs leadership. It needs also the support of a majority government in the Dáil at some point to make the kind of reforms that it needs, that it requires. And it needs to be stood up for by politicians.
And stood up for by journalists. You had the majority in 2011 and yourself...
In the middle of the worst crisis that the country... In the middle of the worst crisis we ever...
Excuse me a second.
No, can I just make this point about the Eighth Amendment, for example, about Simon Harris? I fought with Fine Gael for months on the Eighth Amendment, on the X case, when we couldn't get Fine Gael around to supporting it. On the primary care, I introduced primary care, free GP care for under six, for children under six. Mm. We're on the way towards introducing it for others. Mm. We did things in the Department of Health in the teeth of the worst economic crisis the country ever had.
But you now have a party in Fine Gael who have been in power since 2011 who have still have no clear health strategy.
No. That is like not correct.
It's not correct. Could I actually just make one point without you actually jumping in? Like James Riley went in with the idea of dismantling the HSE. He got rid of the board and abolish it. Mm. And that has been reversed. Universal health insurance, you know, I think Brendan Howland public expenditure minister, said it threatened the financial viability of the state in the form that it was presented in. Leo Varadkar went in and didn't seem to do an awful lot in terms of actually developing a health strategy. Mm. We now have Sláinte Care, but by God, as the pace of Sláinte Care.
That's what we need to get behind.
One of the problems that we have in Ireland is we look at the health service here in Ireland and we're not comparing it with other health services. If you look in the UK at the moment, for instance, there's 41,000 vacancies for nurses. You look at them in America at the moment, 530,000 people a year are going into bankruptcy due to...
But is this a case of...
What I'm saying to you, like, you take a simple thing like insulin. Insulin is available here in Ireland, and rightly so, to people with diabetes. And you look at the States...
Since 1971.
We're developing a health service every year. We've changed and we've improved our health service. And if you look at life expectancy in this country, you take women, they have the third longest life expectancy in the entire European Union. Men have the seventh longest. Right. That's as a result of
Fine Gael, is it?
No, it's as a result of the people who work in the health service.
So who has the answers, Christine?
Colm, you've had your run there.
Is there a political party or is there a secret of the success or possible success of the health service hiding somewhere that nobody has managed to find. Is that what we're saying? Is that what we're saying? Every minister of health that's gone in there has made mistakes. Most ministers have gone there have done good things as well. What it needs is a level of political maturity and support for what's happening.
I think the point is that Alan Kelly is saying about that the health service shouldn't be described as Angola. I don't think anybody would dispute the fact that once you get into the healthcare system in Ireland, it's probably one of the best in the world. The problem is that you depend on politicians, on officials, on the organisation to make access that little bit easier for people. And that just has not been solved in how many years and how many parties and how many health ministers have been there.
And the answer is in plain sight, because care. I mean, the answer is, or should be, Slán to Care. Now, despite Simon Harris in his tweet today claiming credit for it, I mean, this is an all-party group which had minimal input from the government and every party subscribed to it. And now it's his job actually to implement it, and he hasn't really been doing a huge amount to implement it.
Can I put you, though, that something that I heard Teresa Reedy from UCC pointing out today, that the analysis of the last four elections has indicated that actually dysfunction in health is now priced into the calculation for a vote by the vast majority of the electorate. And in that way,
that shouldn't be the excuse for politicians doing nothing or not actually implementing a strategy, that somehow the people don't vote along those lines. I mean, the Department of Health, I mean, I couldn't believe today when the Taoiseach described it as some kind of an apprenticeship. I mean, it's, I think, the second biggest spending department in the state after social welfare. It's absolutely incredible. I mean, this requires real good leadership. And I thought it was quite ironic.
But I wonder, is that somewhere built into the political system now, that actually, given that everybody seems to have failed at health...
Of course it is. When you're running overruns or there are bailouts to the Department of Health 16 or 17 years in a row, that's normalised behaviour. That's not an exception anymore. That's normalised behaviour. I think ultimately...
That's since Fine Gael came in.
No, 16 years.
No, it was the case prior to that as well.
That was when there was supplementary assistance for extra stuff. It wasn't just to keep the thing running.
We have to face the fact that health is going to cost more and more all the time. And politically, we have to face up to the fact that we're going to have to spend more on health. And that has implications for taxation as well. It also has implications for people thinking they can reduce taxes, parties thinking they can reduce taxes and have a so-called world-class health service. You can't do that. You've got to fund it properly. You've got to spend more money on having an excellent health service. And we've got to all face up as politicians of all parties, take the criticism that I'll take the criticism for the Labour Party that we have played politics with it in the past as well, just as other parties have. But it's time for people to come together and actually implement something like Slán to Care. Take the really harsh edge of the politics out of it and do something good for the country.
You must also make sure that in providing money for healthcare that you're getting value for money and that you're getting a service that's delivered. And for instance, one of the big issues that we have and the big challenges here, we're spending over 2.4 billion, for instance, in relation to drugs and pharmaceuticals. Are we getting value for money in that? And that's a big challenge. And we're constantly being lobbied about new drugs coming on market. And we have drug companies then setting a very high price, which is a huge challenge that we have to deal with.
That's a whole other debate.
Okay, I want to move on. But before I go, just a few tweets or a few texts we've got in on this. Accountability actually means being fired if you screw up. Well, at least it does in the private sector, says Keith in Dublin 2. Chris in Cork says, and what will Fianna Fáil do if the Brexit deadline is extended? We'll come back to that perhaps later on. Fianna Fáil are pursuing a strategy that they will pay a price for on election day. Is there some pollster or advisor telling Micheál Martin they can benefit from this strategy? That's, as I say, Chris in Cork. And finally, Evan wonders, would President Higgins refuse a dissolution of the Dáil at this time? Well, talking about dissolutions of parliaments, I want to go now to Westminster. Because while Fianna Fáil is saying that Brexit is their reason for trying to steady the Irish ship of state over in the UK, three Conservative MPs are blaming it for jumping ship to the independent group. I feel like we should try and slip in a Titanic joke here, but I haven't worked it in yet. John Rentall, chief political commentator with the Independent newspaper in Britain, is on the line. Good evening, John.
Hello there.
John, three Tory defections today after the eight Labour defections yesterday.
Yes.
The independent group now, we're just adding up the numbers here, have more MPs than the DUP.
Indeed, one more.
Yes.
And more expected tomorrow.
More expected, yes. I mean, in the current chaos in Westminster, are these numbers in any way significant?
Not yet. They'd have to get up to 36 to be... really significant. I mean, then that's when they would overtake the SNP and become the third largest party and be entitled to two questions at Prime Minister's Questions every week, which
I mean, it's only symbolic, but I mean, that would be quite a visible breakthrough. But, you know, they've got a long way to go yet.
And you say more expected tomorrow. How many more? From where?
Well, I mean, I've seen all sorts of rumours. I'm afraid, you know, I know as much as you do from reading Twitter. But, you know, I was sceptical on Monday about the initial wave of seven. I thought when seven of them actually walked into that room, I was quite impressed. I mean, it's very difficult to herd cats or to get Labour MPs into one place to agree on one thing. So I wouldn't dismiss the rumours that there'll be maybe up to three tomorrow.
Right. I mean, this must all be really contributing to a very febrile atmosphere in Westminster at the moment.
Well, it's a bit busy, yeah. Yeah, we journalists are having a grand old time. But I mean, this is serious stuff, and it's the strains of Brexit, I think, that finally broken some of the bonds of party loyalty, which have been under a lot of pressure for some time. I mean, what's odd about this, the timing of all this, is that, I mean, today's defections were three Tories complaining about Theresa May, you know, not ruling out leaving the EU without a deal. But, I mean, the House of Commons is going to vote on that next week. I mean, their chance to stop that is the Yvette Cooper plan, which the Commons will vote on next Wednesday. And yet they couldn't wait. They had to leave now. And I think that sort of tells you a lot about the emotional pressures that a lot of MPs are under.
Yeah, I saw Anna Soubry saying this evening that this hard right-wing element of the party that has bedeviled every Tory leader for 40 years is now running the show.
Well, I don't know what she's talking about. I mean, you know, that's not... Theresa May is not a hard right-wing, hard Brexiteer at all. And the idea that she's sort of given in to the ERG, to the Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson lot, is for the birds, because, I mean, the whole point about Boris Johnson is he's on the back benches because he didn't agree with the government policy and he didn't like it and he's legged it.
But will the fact that the moderates are now moving out of the party make it, you know, swing even further over towards the Jacob Rees-Mogg wing?
No, but I mean, actually, the other sensible thing that Anna Soubry did say today was that this defection doesn't actually alter the arithmetic in Parliament on Brexit at all. I mean, it doesn't matter what party label MPs have. There are three groups of MPs in the House of Commons. There are those who want to leave without a deal. There are those who support the Prime Minister's deal, and there are those who are opposed to Brexit altogether and want a second referendum. And she and all her colleagues in the independent group are in that last category. They all want to stop Brexit, and it doesn't matter which label they have. They're still in a minority in the House of Commons, as are the other two groups. And that's the whole problem that we have in British politics at the moment.
It looks like Theresa May came back from Brussels empty-handed, as predicted, John.
Well, yes, but we don't know what's going on behind the scenes, do we? I mean, I think the EU is keen to provide something. I mean, we're all very sceptical about how meaningful it would be, but it would be, you know, a legally binding document of some kind, which would clarify the withdrawal agreement, and we simply don't know what kind of negotiations have been going on behind the scenes on that. And I suspect there may be a bit more going on than we know about.
But is there any real expectation that there is any way she's going to be able to extract enough to, you know, get her majority for this deal in Westminster?
Well, that's not going to be the only way she's going to get... If she gets her deal through the House of Commons, it won't be just because of that, but it might be because of a combination of things. You know, the one thing we do know about is that there isn't a majority for leaving without a deal. So if Theresa May can't do anything before next Wednesday, they're supposed to be voting on the Yvette Cooper plan, which is to legislate to rule out no deal Brexit. Now, if that happens,
then Parliament faces a very simple choice, which is the Prime Minister's deal or delaying Brexit. And, you know, that could be how she gets her deal through in the end.
That actually the hard Brexit here is when faced with the possibility of a delay, which may mean a no Brexit,
exactly,
will actually finally come on board.
Yes, I mean, well, that's assuming they behave rationally. I mean, you know, I've heard...
That's a pretty big assumption, given what we've seen over the last number of months.
I mean, there are certainly hard Brexiteers who say they would rather stay in the EU than accept Theresa May's deal, which is just the most extraordinary position to have gotten themselves into. It just shows you what kind of looking-glass world British politics has got into. But, you know, there are certainly Tory MPs who would take that view, but I think what's more likely is that there will be a significant number of the so-called no dealers who will decide to hold their noses and vote for the Prime Minister's deal, and they will be supported by a significant number of Labour MPs who don't want to delay Brexit, who don't want a second referendum. They just want to get on with it.
So it'll all be grand. It'll all work out on the night.
Well, it might do. I mean, personally, I think that fears of a no-deal Brexit are exaggerated, because I think I don't think that Theresa May would allow that to happen in the end. I just don't think that's in her character. But it doesn't. I mean, it sort of doesn't matter what she wants. I think the House of Commons won't allow it.
Okay, we leave it there, John Rentall. I'm sure we'll speak again very soon on the latest developments there. But for now, John Rentall, Chief Political Commentator with the Independent Newspaper in the UK. Thank you for that. So, John Rentall there, Alex White, thinking... Yeah. That ultimately the prospect of a big, long delay in Brexit will push the hard Brexiteers into line.
Yeah, and I suppose the objective for Theresa May has to be, can she get just enough, call it a fig leaf, call it an excuse for people who voted one way a couple of weeks ago to change their minds. Politicians, you know, when they change their minds so quickly, need a reason, even if it's not a hugely compelling reason to explain to the public, but they need something.
A fig leaf, I think, is the word you're looking for there.
Yeah, exactly. So can she deliver that? And can she switch? And I think your question is insightful about the people who are leaving the parties. It doesn't, you know, does it pull away the moderates from within the party, so-called moderates from within those parties, particularly the Conservative Party? But as John Rentall says, the numbers are still the same. It's just they're not members of the party. So can she deliver something to make? And I rather think that that's what the game is. And, you know, it looks to me like that's, I mean, obviously that's what the objective is. The Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General, I mean, there's, you know, all of the brains and all of the brawn, and everybody is really trying to push towards, can they deliver something, so even if it's something small?
But it's clear as day, though, like Theresa May can't do anything other than bring it to the cliff edge. Because if she was to kind of almost seek to try and do a deal now, she's 2 weeks of like a potential backlash from the Jacob Rees-Mogg's. There was always going to be an element of brinkmanship, I think, in this, given how weak her position is. But I suppose, you know, we're playing with live ammunition here, really. And that's terrifying, isn't it?
I mean, the
uncertainty in itself is doing massive damage. Apart from whatever damage Brexit or a no-deal Brexit would do, the uncertainty is just really dangerous for Britain, and that is having then an effect on us. And that's the worrying part.
But I think also the fact that, you know, you take Honda now deciding to close down in Swindon. If you look at the vote in Swindon, 54.7% voted to leave.
Now, of course, Honda are maintaining now that this isn't to do with Brexit.
Well, I know, but in real terms, look, there's a huge European market that a lot of the car manufacturing companies are exporting into. And you take, you know, the Japanese companies now, I think there's about 800,000 people working either directly or indirectly in the car industry in the UK. And they must be very worried about, you know, not having the same access to 440 million people. And that's what a no Brexit deal will
mean more expensive cars for Britain and then for us as well. Obviously.
But it just hasn't been about the economic arguments for months. Like, that's the extraordinary thing about it. The economic arguments are staring everybody in the face, but they seem to be just ignored.
And what's interesting as well, if you see Jacob Rees-Mogg on any of these shows, and anyone who, like any interviewer, tries to pin him down, he reverts to the ideology.
You know,
independence, like we're standing on our own two feet. He cannot in any way, convincingly respond to those.
I think if there was another major, you know, manufacturer decides, you know, announces in the next week or so that they're considering moving, I think it might bring more people to the reality of what a no Brexit deal will mean. Because it's a huge market that they're now walking away from.
I think it's interesting, though, to mention the possible side deals or back deals that are going on with the negotiations, because I think Theresa May, when she goes off to Brussels, it has been somewhat of a humiliating trips back and forth, and these statements come out about we had grand chats and sure we agreed on the same thing that we've always been agreed on. So I think she does need to scramble for something else that she can bring back, be it a change, a political also, declaration, legally binding, something
European
that
Union
she can
need
sell.
To bring back for us. Basically, the backstop. I mean, you know, as Paul Cunningham famously described it in the video he did, the unbreakable agreement not to have a hard border in Ireland. That's what has to happen, no matter what.
Talk about what's going to happen here in the next few weeks now. We're going to have the legislation going to be rolled out on Friday, this omnibus bill. Mm. And then we are going to have to, some way, as we go up towards the deadline, there will surely have to be some discussion about what may happen.
Yeah, I mean, what we've been told essentially the last 24 hours or so is that the first week of March, essentially, they've penciled in a number of cabinet meetings, at which stage they kind of have to make a number of make or break decisions as to contingency planning, you know, aid, all that kind of stuff.
The truth that we dare not speak its name up to now, basically.
Yeah, basically. And ultimately what you're getting...
And it's a huge challenge because, like, you take, for instance, you take the beef industry, it's 2.5 billion... per annum, about 52% of that is going to the UK, and it's a huge
challenge.
There were
some very hair-raising reports today of the plans, Michael Gove's plans in relation to tariff.
Plans? I mean, he said one thing on Saturday and then a different thing on Tuesday. I mean,
he was speaking at a farmers' conference yesterday and there was
I'm talking now about what was leaked to the farmers' journal today.
But that's the point. But they keep changing. They don't know what they're doing, and yet the effect that it's going to have on us is going to be absolutely catastrophic. Yeah. I mean, it could collapse a major part of our farming sector in this country. It's really worrying, and it doesn't seem like the government here really is totally on the ball about it. I mean, everything is happening
The government have been in contact with between all the departments, over 80,000 people or 80,000 companies have either been directly or indirectly involved with the state agencies in relation to planning for this thing. And it's a huge challenge that just gives you the extent of the challenge that is there for each and every company.
But it's very much down to crunch time in terms of these cabinet meetings and the omnibus Brexit bill. You know, we've had sort of briefings about all the changes, but they've been sort of vague, I suppose, promises of, well, we'll sort out the ports and we'll sort out if you're getting a bus up to the north and we'll box that all off. And now it actually is coming down to the last number of weeks where people actually want, I suppose, concrete answers about how they're going to go about their daily lives if, in fact, there is a worst case.
We're putting on our civil service here, having a briefing next week as TDs
get all of this on in what order. The position would be with driving in the north of Ireland. I mean, that's the position. So, I mean, can I just say this again? Who would thank Fianna Fáil if there was an election cause on our account? And I say that to some of our strongest supporters as well, who are very impatient. But the whole thing is crazy at the moment, and it's not of our making.
And it's the uncertainty, you know, it's the deep uncertainty. And even for, I mean, we look to the government for answers, look to the civil service. And I think a lot of work has been done. It'd be interesting to read the legislation. But there are questions that have never been asked before. So there isn't somewhere where we can look to see, well, how do you do this if you have this kind of problem? Because we've never had this kind of problem. And you're right. I mean, this cut right through employment across the country. You mentioned agriculture, but there are other areas as well in terms of industry, particularly older, as somebody was making the point today, less protected, you know, or more, you know, industry like textiles and the older industries in the country that are already kind of perhaps
struggling
difficult. The government, I mean, I think it's for the government to give leadership, but I don't think we can expect all the answers to be given immediately, even in this legislation. It's going to be really difficult.
The challenge as well, though, is in relation to transport of goods across to Europe. I mean, we go through the UK and there's a whole challenge in that area as well, in the ports going from, you know, going
from
the UK.
Well, surely that must be one of the biggest challenges.
Oh, that's the biggest challenge.
How do we manage without that land bridge?
Well, I mean, look, there's part of the legislation is to legislate for travel to Belfast by train. It's incredible. I mean, it is so fundamental. Questions that we've never asked that we are faced with now, and this will go on as well for a long time. I mean, there could be a short extension, we don't know, but there will still be major questions. There will be issues that arise possibly that no one has foreseen.
What about if there is a lengthy extension, Thomas Byrne, in relation to confidence in supply? Take us back to the domestic political situation.
Yeah, well, the domestic political situation is always a bit of crack, a bit of a joke, you know, but we're surrounded by the seriousness of Brexit. And I refer you back really to Micheál Martin's speech of the 12th of December in the Dáil, and actually our position has not changed since that. And Micheál Martin said that we would actually go through this year.
And have you no difficulty with that?
No, because I think he's actually doing the right thing. I mean, that is what we believe is in the interest of this country, and we will put the question. Michal,
the royal we now doesn't seem to cover all of Fianna Fáil.
It's not a royal we.
We are from the royal county, look.
Yeah, but
it'll be interesting to gauge the mood, I suppose, at the Fianna Fáil Ardesh this weekend in terms of whether the grassroots are backing Micheál Martin's strategy to write this out for another year.
I can say this: they are backing Micheál Martin's strategy, but there is huge frustration that we are not in power. Our members are, as we are impatient.
Are they not getting absolutely in the neck, your local councillors knocking around doors saying that you're keeping Fine Gael?
Certainly that is being said to us. I was out knocking doors myself. I got a great reception there with our local candidate, Mr. Mullen, Lisa Meller, on Monday.
But
there were some very strong Fianna Fáil supporters who expressed frustration. There's no doubt about that.
I think
absolutely.
But can I put you, Thomas? In the last short while, we've had Niall Collins, we've had Willie O'Dea, we've had Barry Andrews, we've had very senior figures within the Fianna Fáil party, letting it be known that basically bets should be off. If there is any stability, any long-term stability in terms of where this Brexit is going, then we have to relook at this confidence and supply deal.
I'm as frustrated as anybody. I would love Fianna Fáil to be in power. But
sorry, you can just respond to that. What do you make of that? Surely that can't be dismissed.
I heard Niall Collins then speaking on radio. I don't think he changes. I don't think he really deviated that much from what Micheál Martin said. Mm. At some point, there's going to be an election. That's guaranteed. That will happen. But Micheál has given.
He said that if there is Brexit stability, the government's lifetime could be measured in weeks.
We're here discussing whether we'll be able to drive through the north in a month's time, or whether we'll be able to get the train to Belfast, or whether we'll be able to get our cattle into Europe, or whether we'll be able to sell cattle, or whether our farming sector is going to collapse. Yeah. The question Micheál Martin asked in the Dáil on the 12th of December was, who is going to put the national interest first? And he said very clearly that Fianna Fáil was going to put the national interest
first. Colin, what do you think is going to happen? Let's put a scenario in place. There's a 12-month extension to Brexit.
Yeah. I'm interested in hearing what Thomas is saying about the national interest. I mean, you know, we had a major challenge in 2011. We dealt with that. We're dealing with the Brexit issue. We've stuck strictly to what we decided as regards what's best for the country, and that's what we want to do in government, and that's what we want to continue to do in government for the foreseeable future, as long as
Colm, you've heard all these figures making these remarks over the last week, the same as the rest of us. Do you have a sense that there is a head of steam building in Fianna Fáil, that frustration levels are growing with this?
I'm not invited to the common meetings, so I'm not aware of what their
you're what a their seasoned political hand,
Colm. I'm not
Take
sure
the temperature
what
for me.
Well, I'm quite happy that we have delivered on a whole range of areas, and we want to continue.
I can't give you what's happening in Fianna Fáil, but you're an observer of Fianna Fáil in the same way as I am.
And there's a lot of figures in Fianna Fáil, and you listed some of them who are making these statements. They remind me of the guy, you know, who's in sort of half into a fight and says, "Hold me back." You know, he's sort of half taken off his jacket. He's pretending he's going to have a crack, and he's not going to have a crack. And they're not. I mean, most of these people, it suits them to communicate the fact that they're frustrated. But they want their voters to know that they're frustrated, but they're not actually going to take action. I think Thomas is right in his own judgment of his own colleagues. They're not going to come forward, and they're not going to pull the plug, certainly not at the moment,
but perhaps not even later in the year. That's the reality of it. Why aren't they, Alex?
Because they're following the leadership of their leader, and they're trusting him. He's the guy at the wheel, so they'll stick with him for as long as it suits. And I think, you know, secondly, they're making a calculation as to what would happen if there was a general election. And I think they do not calculate that they will necessarily do all that well in a general election. I think they'll do better, perhaps, than some people think. But, I mean, if we look at the arithmetic in the Dáil, it's conceivable just about that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael might swap numbers in the Dáil. Just about conceivable. But nobody is going to get an overall majority. No. And it may even be a question. May even be a question mark as to whether any group of parties can get a majority in the Dáil, given how dysfunctional it is, and given the cards that everybody was dealt after the last general election. And what you're looking at here still is a legacy of the crash. Fianna Fáil was, you know, not annihilated, but did very, very badly in 2011. We were nearly wiped out in 2016, right? Fine Gael did badly in 2016 as well, people forget. So the party political configuration of the Dáil has been changed fundamentally since the crash. And that's what we're looking at here. And I think another general election, there has to be a question mark as to whether things would change all that much. Obviously, I think the Labour Party would do better. How much better, we're not sure. So the question, they're making a calculation politically, but they're also doing, I'll just finish on this, what they're also doing is the corollary of doing nothing, of not pulling the plug in Fianna Fáil is that you're going to continue to have this Dáil, which is effectively ground to a halt as a real parliament. I mean, there are no votes. Alan Kelly said today, like, the votes have no meaning anymore in the Dáil. There's bills brought forward, there's motions, they're passed, all the rest of it. Nothing happens. So, like, there's no real decisions on the big, we're talking about health earlier, no decisions being made on the great questions facing the Irish people.
So then, in the interest of the country, should we not have an election and but Alex, at least shake up what's happening.
So, well, I mean,
as you describe it, the Dáil as it is currently constituted,
as Thomas says,
is dysfunctional.
There has to be an election at some point. I think right now there's not going to be an election. But Alex, we're in a crisis. There will have to be an election at some point.
Danny, you're trying to get in there.
Yeah, there's two things. I accept, and certainly speaking to a number of people, I was off for a couple of weeks, so I'm only kind of dipping back into but taking the temperature. It's very clear that level of frustration has certainly upped a level or two, and you know it's kind of reflected in the comments from John McGuinness, Niall Collins, Willie O'Dea and elsewhere. I'm not convinced that, you know, should a year-long extension of, you know, Article 50 spark an immediate election. I do struggle to see how we get another budget through, just given the personalities involved, given the sort of the level of kind of
decision. I'll give you the last word on this, Tom.
Yeah, just one thing Micheál said also in the Dáil on the 12th of December is that, you know, it's not outside the bounds of possibility that the government itself will stumble out of office, that they will just collapse themselves. And that could have happened today had more than Michael Hartey walked away from them. And that has threatened to happen on a number of occasions. So that could happen too. But certainly Fianna Fáil thinks that this is an unprecedented guarantee of support in the national interest.
Okay. Decisions are being made on a daily basis by the government, whether it's the children's hospital, whether it's in relation to long-term planning. That's all being done by this government.
That was a bad example to choose.
But we've taken a decision to move on with it, not park it for another 10 years, which a lot of people want us to do.
Okay. We're going to have to take a break there. But stay with us because we want to talk about property tax after these.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE.
Have you ever dreamed?
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back to Wednesday's Late Debate. With me in studio tonight, we have Fine Gael Senator Colin Burke, Fianna Fáil TD Thomas Byrne, the Irish Examiner's Daniel McConnell, the journalist Christina Finn and Labour Councillor Alex White. Now, Fianna Fáil spokesperson on housing, Dara O'Brien, has drafted legislation that would set a cap on the amount of property tax paid by people who also pay management or maintenance fees on their properties. Finance Minister Pascal Donoghue has deferred the bill until it considers a review of local property tax, which we are told is due shortly. This is a big issue for, would be a big issue for any government facing into any election. The property tax levels have been frozen since 2013. Were they to be revisited before the election, it could have very serious political consequences.
I mean, what we've had is very clearly is a lack of political will to really, like, I mean, the IMF and other international bodies have said this is a golden revenue stream that you should really capitalise on, but politically we've just said absolutely not. So Michael Noonan froze it initially, it was, you know, and then it, you know, they've been frozen out to the end of this year. What you have though is an anomaly that every house built since 2013 is exempt from property tax. They're not included in that, and that number is about 65,000-66,000 houses.
Was that for a certain number of years? That must be about to run out now.
That's like until the legislation has changed, they remain exempt. But what you have, I suppose, is, you know, how do you keep the rate of, or the amount that you pay constant, but yet not, you know, really affect people. So, I mean, Pascal Dunne has made it clear that they'll find out a mechanism to reduce the rate to make sure that people's, you know, kind of bills stay pretty constant. However, I suppose what you're now seeing from Fianna Fáil is kind of, and from the Independent Alliance as well within government, is they want to see, you know, exemptions for the elderly exemptions for the sick. So you're kind of saying, well, it all will fall back then on the squeeze middle once again, who will pay for everything. So, but there is, the big question is, you know, Pascal Dunne says there's a review underway which will determine the overall rate. There's a real question mark in my mind that this government would actually see another budget through. So what happens to the Fianna Fáil bill is very much in the land of the unknown.
But I mean, the Fianna Fáil bill that's in the Dáil this week is really to give relief to those who are also paying management fees on top of the property tax, and they could be in apartments, they could be in housing, large housing estates which are mixed and where there's management fees as well, and we'll give relief of a third of either the property tax or the management fee, or €300, whichever is the lowest amount. And I think that would be very important, because effectively these people in these estates, and we're talking about owner occupiers here, not landlords or tenants, they're paying on the double actually for some services that management companies provide that councils ordinarily would provide.
Colin.
And we think this is fair. And by the way, this is something we've been pushing for a number of years, even in the Shannon when I was there with Darragh O'Brien, something we pushed. Sean Fleming put it forward in the last Dáil as well. And the government don't seem that supportive of it. They put Sean, but at the same time, they put Sean Kenny, a relatively low profile minister who wouldn't have a huge amount of managed estates in his constituency, into the Dáil last night. Fine Gael weren't really openly objecting to it, which they realise it's pretty dangerous. And this is a big issue. This is a big issue where a lot of the squeeze middle actually live in these estates and are paying very significant management fees.
I think, Colin, you know, one of the problems that we have in this country is that we narrowed our tax base away too much, going back over the years. And by having property tax, you're widening the tax base. And, you know, we felt the worst of that when we had a sudden decrease in the number of people employed. The property tax is there as a mechanism. And I think one of the things is that if you take people who are in apartments, but if you take someone who's in a three-bedroom, semi-detached house, they still have maintenance costs as well. Part of the management fee is a sinking fund for providing, upgrading and maintaining the common areas as well.
So you're saying you totally disagree with this?
I'm not saying I'm ruling it out completely, but I'm saying to you, certainly I have no difficulty about looking at it, but I think you've got to take into account that a person who has the three-bedroom, semi-detached house has maintenance costs as well, which they have to pay out of their own pocket, whether it's external, whether it's simple things like cleaning the chutes and painting the house, but they have to do
it. But we're talking about the maintenance of common areas. That's what you pay management fees for,
But you also pay for a sinking fund, which the person who has the three-bedroom house also has to do on the regular
basis. Okay, what about your Fine Gael colleague, Josepha Madigan, calling for a special consideration for people whose houses are worth an awful lot of money, such as, for instance, people who live in Josepha Madigan's constituency?
All I'm saying in relation to property tax, it's important that it's equitable.
No, sir, I'm not asking you about a general thing about property tax. I'm asking you about Josepha Madigan's plea for her constituents and the fact that they would have to pay perhaps sharp increases were the property tax to be now matched with the current property tax.
Well, I think Pascal O'Donoghue has made it clear that one of the things that we don't want is a property tax that's, I suppose, unfair to people and inequitable. And I think it's important that we take all
the issues. So would it be inequitable for people with very valuable property not to pay property tax on that basis?
No. I'm not saying that they wouldn't pay property tax, but that there isn't a sudden and a very substantial increase in property tax.
No, but come on, there's a game going on here.
No, right? There's no game going on.
No, sorry, there's a game going on. Listen now, listen to somebody else now for a minute. Listen to somebody else for a minute. You have to get a certain amount of revenue from the property tax, right, to run the country, or to be the contribution towards running the country. If you reduce it for people in Dublin Rathdown, by the way, a constituency that I represented, it has to go up for somebody else if you want to actually keep the same revenue coming into the coffers. So there is a game going on. This sort of suggestion that we might be able to tinker with it here and maybe help people in this area, it means other people are going to have to pay more. So let's be honest. It's like the health debate. There's an absence of honesty. I'm not saying Colm is being dishonest, but there's an absence of candour with the people. And I actually think that the Fianna Fáil proposal, I don't agree with it, because I groan when I hear this thing of tax breaks. It's more tinkering. The management charges. What about the people in Thomas's constituency who have to maintain the lane down to the main road? Are they going to get a tax break on their property tax? Like, we should keep... Danny is right. It was hugely difficult to bring this in politically. It was a Troika-inspired move. That's true as well. All parties had political difficulties with it, including my own. But it's there now. It's a robust tax. It means that we can actually spread the burden away from income tax, but I think, and let's not try and whittle it down with these tinkering measures.
The local property tax has always been a toxic issue for any political party, and it tends to surface, be it with tax breaks or with this line from Pascal Donoghue. I think it was around the thinking at the same time for Fine Gael was, you know, fair and affordable. equity, you know, but there was still no detail about what exactly that means for Joe
Blogg.
Anyway,
we're all sort of, this idea, one thing that's always struck me about the local
property tax is what about the situation where, as many people were in up until very recently anyway, people who were actually in negative equity, so they were paying a tax on a debt, and they were, it seems to me to be always an extraordinary thing that why it's one thing to pay a tax on your equity in your own property, but if you don't own or only own 5% of that property, is there not a case to be made that that is very unfair?
There was huge obstacle. There was huge adversity to local property tax when it first came in, but they rolled it out well in terms of how they deducted it from people.
It was rammed through the door. It wasn't rolled out well.
No, it rolled out well in terms of collecting the money from people.
Absolutely, and that was rammed through the door.
It was in the Fianna Fáil manifesto in 2011.
It wasn't.
Let's not forget.
It was not. There was a site value tax.
Still a property tax.
No, the site value tax is completely different.
Okay, one voice.
In terms of water charges and how they rolled that out, it was a lot better in terms of how they managed to get the money out of people's pockets.
It's quite ruthless the way they went about it with the revenue commissioners.
But the reason we had to change it, bring about changes, is because of the deficits that she left and the mess that she left in 2011. We were in
8 years
ago. We were spending over 20 million more, 20 billion more a year per annum than what we were getting.
But I think it's the people that Danny didn't mention about the people. It is the people that Danny mentioned there, the people who have been exempt for the last number of years. Leo Varadkar did indicate, I think, around Christmas time, that that was unfair and that those people would be rolled back into the system to ensure that everybody had to pay something. So that's the one certainty that we seem to have gotten. But I think that was in the same breath that he said he was bringing in carbon tax. So,
we're not expecting to see this solidified any time before the local elections.
Well, the review is due shortly, is back. But I mean, I can imagine it getting lost somewhere in the floors of the Department of Finance.
There might have to be a long review of the review, might there?
I would think so. Given, I mean, it's politically toxic. I mean, any move, I mean, I just think back to the shenanigans that went on between Labour and Fine Gael and the run-ups of locals in 2014 on the water charges. Yeah. I mean, it was toxic. Mm. It did both parties great damage. And I would think if Pascal Dunne, who's smart, that review will get lost somewhere for a couple of weeks until people go to the polls, and then it might emerge during the summer.
Alex?
Oh, I agree. I think that that's what's likely to happen. Sorry, I'm not advocating it, but I think you're certainly not going to see a review before the local elections, whether you'll see one at all. I mean, if somebody had a big idea down in Merrion Street as to how this could be done and the fairness and the adjustment that Colin was talking about, do you think we wouldn't have heard about it before now? Like, follow the money. The state needs the revenue from the property tax. If, but, by the way, even you have to change, even the change that Thomas's party's in terms of the management fees, that's 17 million gone from local authorities. Where are we going to get that from? You've got to, like, I thought we had reached the stage now where we don't put out uncosted.
So it
proposals.
Is costed.
Well, yeah, 17 million. But you haven't told us where you're going to get that from.
Said it's coming
where
from
are you going to get it from? You're
going
to deprive the local authorities. And I think it's a pity, like, to have the private estates. If people want to live in a private estate, that's fine, a gated community.
They're not, sorry, they're, sorry, they're right. Not gated communities.
Well, in many cases, they are.
They're not,
but it's not an issue.
But
the issue is, you pay for that, and what we need is revenue to pay for all of it.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there, folks. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to my panel. Irish Examiner leading with midwife urges HSE to settle so she can get life prolonging drug. And the Times Ireland edition goes with Harris survives despite attacks from all sides. Tonight's programme was produced by Penny Hart. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Ruth Kennington was on sound.